Shut up.
I have to feed the rabbit.
You're making so much noise.
You just wait 2 seconds till I'm done.
This song is about to become very appropriate because of what's going to happen to you. Welcome to the new podcast episode show. This is
inaugural. Rob. Use the word inaugural.
This is the inaugural episode of Rob Knows Music featuring Joey. I am your host, Joey. And this show is Robbie G and I taking a hard, tough, abrasive, deep, and penetrating look at the bands we like and their discogs. So for this and for the next, we are
penetration.
Approximately 5 episodes. We'll be looking at the history, the recordings, the legacy of Talking Heads.
Talking Heads.
Now, do you say Talking Heads or the Talking Heads?
I don't know. It depends. Ask me a question about them and that I can answer.
What's the name of that band we're talking about?
The Talking Heads. I say the!
Yeah.
See?
Turns out you're not supposed to.
No. Burn, Talking Heads.
He doesn't like the definite article.
Okay.
That's why they always refer to them as Talking Heads, not the Talking Heads.
Oh.
But I think a lot of people say the Talking Heads.
Right.
And really, who is David Byrne to tell us what to do?
He's not the god of me, Joe.
So yes, so this
I
is part one of probably
Bahamut.
Five, or as I like to call it, Talking Heads Talking Heads. We're just a couple of Talking Heads, and what are we talking?
Talking Heads, Joe!
That's what we're talking.
That's exactly what we're talking.
Now you're talking. Why do you keep peeking?
Keep talking.
You have like the loudest voice of all the podcasts I do. What's
keep
that about?
Peeking? Me? This guy?
Yeah, you're peeking.
Peeking! Oh, ever since I was a young child, I've had an affinity towards peeking.
Pecan.
I peek.
I have pecan pie in the fridge.
You do. Show off. Congrats.
So let's really get into it. Let's get right into
dive,
the
delve.
Gritty,
want to delve?
The dirty, the dark and dirty.
So I'm going to admit something to you. Here's an admission.
All right.
Of guilt, perhaps. Not until this week had I heard Talking Heads 77 in its entirety.
Wow.
Isn't that bonkers?
A little bit.
How bonkers is that?
Pretty bonkers.
Pretty bonkers.
Well, we'll get into it.
Oh, we're going to get into that.
We're going to get into that. Well,
delve.
I thought maybe, I mean, this is the beginning. We should start at the beginning and say, Rob, when did you first listen to the Talking Heads? What's your history with the Talking Heads?
Just this last
talking
week.
Talking Heads, shit.
Just this last week.
I don't think that's true.
Oh, no, it's not. Well, let me tell you an interesting story, which is convenient.
Is it about this microphone? Is it about Talking Heads?
It's about Talking Heads.
Even better.
It's going to tie into Talking Heads. It
Excellent.
First starts, I'm a young boy.
You're a little boy. You wanted to be a big boy?
No, don't. I was in junior high school, okay?
I went to that.
Learning. I was learning.
I did.
It was at a school that you attended. It
doesn't fucking matter at all.
Also, as a teen. Ager.
This part is so unimportant.
And attending this school, all right, I had many teachers, instructors.
Yep, yep. No, we all know how school works.
I was a pupil. I was a student.
Does this get to Talking Heads soon?
Well, quit interrupting me.
You're
and maybe
stage.
We'll
okay,
get there.
Yeah, you're in a school. You're a little boy.
I'm a little boy in a school.
In a school.
I'm in a school. There are teachers
yep,
almost everywhere.
We've established that there are teachers in your school.
There are students
yes.
in classes
yes.
next to me.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I had a particular class with a particular teacher, and his name was Mr. G. All right.
Okay.
Now, Mr. G.
I remember Mr. G.
He didn't have any hair, okay?
Again, not relevant to the story.
Tucked in his shirt.
That's true. He did
sometimes
that.
Wore glasses. Sometimes taught gym.
Did
sometimes
teach
taught drama.
I don't remember him teaching gym. But again, not relevant.
Jim was one of those students. At my school?
There's no children named Jim.
That's a good point.
Jim is only... You can only be called Jim once you're in your, like, 40s.
So, my teacher...
Mr. G.
Saw... Mr. G.
Yeah.
Saw me wearing a t-shirt.
Why
a
did you
shirt
speak like this?
In the shape of a T. So I'm
why
trying to make your head explode.
Well, it's working. My talking head is ready to...
So, on my t-shirt was a fish logo.
So you're wearing a fish t-shirt.
Yes.
Okay.
Wearing a fish t-shirt.
We'll get to that
in school.
A second now.
In school.
Okay.
Basically, I'm going to skip all that. My Mr.
Oh,
G.
Will you? Thanks. I'm so glad to hear it. Doesn't sound like you skipped it because it kind of sounds like we spent an hour on it.
So I started trading CDs with Mr. G back and forth. I traded him a lot of Fish CDs because we listened to Fish growing up. And then he got me into bands like Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds and Talking Heads. Not the Talking Heads, Joe. Talking Heads. He gave me a little DVD, digital video disc.
Dubbed video dubbed. It's actually not digital video disc.
What is it?
Digital versatile disc.
But he gave me a digital video disc, though. Which is a different format. This is a different time, Joey. This is the past.
Okay, all right.
And he gave me Stop Making Sense.
Mm-hmm. Which we'll get to Stop Making Sense.
We will. And I watched it, and I thought it was
Yeah, because he has remarkable. The big suit.
Oh, it's great. It's really good.
I'm reading his book, How Music Works.
Yeah.
And I got to a part where he talks about coming up with the big suit. And I was like, yeah, the big suit.
The big suit is fantastic. And I knew about the big suit before I'd seen it because we listened to Fish a lot when we were younger.
Which we'll get to.
Being younger? We'll get to young. Is this a Benjamin Button podcast?
Yep.
I got Stop Making Sense, and then from there, picked up Remain in Light and Fear of Music.
You're misremembering things because that's not how...
Well, I got the DVD Stop Making Sense.
I know that is true. That part's true, but you did not buy... Well, then what's the truth? Well, because I bought Remain in Light.
Show me the truth, then.
All right. I'm getting to it. So, my first exposure, if you will, to Talking Heads... comes from a little guy named Weirdo Al Yankovic.
Oh, he's crazy,
and,
strange.
One of his
profiles
features a little snippet of a ditty from the Speaking in Tongues album called "Burning Down the House," which was Talking Heads' biggest hit.
A song that was in Revenge of the Nerds, while they burned down the house.
Boy, we watched that movie a lot, and I actually talked to somebody on Twitter about that movie today. A cartoonist that I like was watching it. And he was saying how it's a really offensive movie that nobody should watch,
criminal.
But it's pretty funny.
Yeah.
And then I was saying that we used to rewind and watch over and over again the scene where Booger tries to negotiate rent through a door.
Oh my god.
What? It's not for... I thought it was for rent. Fuck off. Why are you here? I thought it was for rent. But anyway, I'd heard that song. And on the second Weird Al album, Polka Party, he has a style pastiche of the Talking Heads called
Doggy Dog.
Dog, yes. Which when you listen to it, has a lot of Talking Heads isms in it, but specifically referencing "Once in a Lifetime," which is one of my favorite Talking Heads songs. But we'll get to that.
Will we?
We will. But then, so that was my first exposure before I even really knew that they were a thing. I'd probably heard "Burning Down the House" on the radio, on the classic rock radio, because that's all I listened to.
Radio station.
Yep. The classic. What used to be called Rock 97. Eventually, that station
became
Rock.
Didn't it become Rock 107 or something?
No, eventually the classic rock station became Q107. But
Q107!
When I was in junior high, Rock 97 was a thing, and it was the classic rock station. You probably don't remember because you were just a little boy.
Just a little boy.
But anyway, so I probably heard that. And then, like you had mentioned, in junior high school, I got into Fish, which to this day is still, probably my top three favorite bands, along with a little band called Talking Heads. But anyway, Fish used to do musical costumes for their Halloween. They still do, but they used to too, which is a Mitch Hedberg joke. Mitch Hedberg was in an episode of That 70 Show I just watched.
I know.
He runs like the hub. He's like the guy at the counter at the hub.
I knew that, actually. I did know that. But he's dead now, Joe.
He is dead. But anyway, got into them, and for their musical costume at Halloween 1996 at the Omni in Atlanta, they covered the Remain in Light in its entirety. And I knew this because I had a book called The Fish Companion where you could read set lists. And so I went to A&B Sound, which was a record store that no longer exists, in Shaughnessy.
Now in its space, a music store where I teach, which is...
No, actually there's a condo where it used to be.
Son of a bitch.
It's just
my memories.
Just down the hill. Yeah, right. Your memories are wrong, like memories so often are. But anyway, I bought Remain in Light, and I remember first listening to it in my grandpa's van.
And
going like, what is this? And you're like, it's Talking Heads, Grandpa. It's great.
No, it wasn't the Talking Heads, Joe. It was Talking Heads.
I said it's Talking Heads.
No, you said it's the Talking Heads, Grandpa.
All right, suck a dick.
You're misremembering what you said to Grandpa.
I guess that's... You're not wrong. You're not wrong. You're just an asshole. But, so I liked that album quite a bit. And then as the years went by, as they are wont to do...
They don't stop, do they? They just keep going.
The years just keep sliding by, don't they?
They're like a train that doesn't stop at a station.
I mean, I guess.
Exactly like a car that never stops driving.
Sure. It's like a simile. So, as the years went by, I liked them more and more, and yeah. And that brings us to today. But yes, the first Talking Heads record I ever purchased was Remain in Light.
Well, then that was probably the first one that I ever heard. Because
yeah, and then you probably eventually bought Fear of Music.
I remember getting Fear of Music in the same purchase that I got a Mars Volta record called Francis the Mute.
The Mute. The
and
the red bag on the
one of those records I still listen to regularly.
Is it Fear of Music?
Yes.
Yeah.
Because Mars Volta, specifically that record, is almost unlistenable. Some of the Mars Volta stuff
I remember
is
you always said I should listen to them. Like, you like prog rock, you like them. And I just
you would like
did.
Their more recent stuff.
I
like,
doubt it.
Like Bedlam and the Goliath is actually kind of Rush.
The only albums that I've ever really listened to that I kind of liked was Deloused and the Comatorium.
That one's fantastic because it's got concise actual songs on it and not just birds chirping for like 20 minutes. Which
I don't
is
know,
what
I like
Fred's
weird bird music.
You like weird bird music.
I listened to the first, last night I listened to the first Brian Eno Robert Fripp album called No Pussyfooting, which is when they were first experimenting with like overdubs and tape delays and stuff. So it's each of them has a side of the album, and it's a 22-minute track for each of them, and they're really cool. But you wouldn't like them.
I don't know about that, because I like experimental acid jazz kind of stuff like that. I really like Robert Fripp, but I don't like...
I don't know. I think you'd like the Robert Fripp side. I don't know if you'd like the Brian Eno side.
Okay.
I like it a lot. I don't know how much you were into, like, weird Brian Eno ambient shit.
I like ambient music.
Okay, well...
I don't like, you'll like it, then. The Mars Volta, Francis the Mute album, mostly... Because there was... I don't remember. It's not very good.
So, point one, Francis the Mute, thumbs down.
Thumbs down. Well, one down, one half to the side. Like Zangief at the end of Street Fighter, the movie.
I remember that. Good stuff. I once got my friend and I in huge trouble after we watched the Street Fighter movie because I made a joke,
jerk.
I think, about Zangief and made coke spray out of his nose, and his dad was like a fucking shithead who just like yelled at us so bad because... This kid had sprayed coke on his nose and made a mess in the kitchen. I'm pretty sure his parents got divorced eventually and she moved to Ottawa because he was a freak show.
For spitting coke on his nose?
Yeah. And if memory serves, like the joke was like, what does it say on the bottom of Zangief's coke can? What? Open other side.
I get it.
And it made him... And that was also the same night where he jumped onto the hide-a-bed and landed on the bar and started screaming and screaming and wailing as he flopped around like a fish screaming he broke his back. And I went, well, probably not because, you know, you're flopping around pretty good. So I remember being very calm and being like, I don't think you broke your back, bud. I think you're okay.
I thought you were going to say, I remember being very, very astute when it came to diagnosing medical conditions of
well,
my
yeah.
friends.
That was
really good.
I had a real Doogie Howser thing going on, but anyway.
Oh, like Doogie Howser?
Yeah.
Shit?
He's a shit doctor.
Mia. Shit doctor.
All right. So, yeah. Talking Heads.
There are still to this day... two Talking Heads records I've never heard, and I'm going to listen to them.
You're gonna have to,
like, ooh. Crazy pants.
Let me guess, it's True Stories and Naked.
I've heard Naked. Naked's the one with the monkey on the front.
Yes.
True Stories is the one with the weird art on the front.
No, True Stories just says True Stories, and She Was has weird art on the front. What
well,
are you talking about?
Let's see this because my
popular favorite has weird art
I have
on the front.
Google
Sand and the Vaseline has art.
True
on
Stories
the front.
Just says Talking Heads on the front.
Right, that's what I meant.
Right. Not the Talking Heads or anything.
What are you talking about? With
Little Creatures. I haven't
yeah,
heard
Little
Creatures.
Creatures
or True Stories.
You probably heard bits of it, because Little Creatures is by far their most accessible album. It has stuff like And She Was on it and Road to Nowhere.
I assume we'll get there one day.
Oh, we'll get there. And you've heard those songs.
Probably.
And She Was is one of the only Talking Heads songs they play on the radio. That and Burning Down the House.
Burning Down the House. That one, right?
We'll get to
getting
it.
Ahead of myself.
But let's take a trip back... In the Wayback Machine, to a little year called 1977.
Star Wars!
Star
right?
Wars, and a little band, little boy by the name of David Byrne and his friends, Chris and Tina Weymouth, and...
Tina Weymouth. Tina fucking Weymouth.
Actually, I'm not even sure if that's correct.
Yes,
it
is.
Might be Chris and Tina France.
Nope, Tina Weymouth.
Tina Weymouth and Chris France. And
yeah.
then she eventually marries Chris France and
yes.
becomes Tina France, what I was thinking. But anyway, she's Tina Weymouth.
Tina?
He's Chris France. They got married.
Fucking Weymouth.
She originally played bass in the band because they needed a bass player. And Chris said, I should ask Tina.
Well, I have a lot to say about Tina fucking Weymouth.
She's quite good. And they started off as a... Can I do some history here? So they were a three-piece when they were playing CBGB back in the day. CBGB.
Did you see that documentary about CBGBs?
I didn't see a documentary.
It's not a documentary.
I saw the end of the movie and a bit in the middle when some guy played David Byrne.
Right, because I saw a preview for it, and in the preview there's people as talking heads. It doesn't look very good,
but
it looked interesting enough just to see recreations of bands like that, just because I'm curious.
I mean, it was literally like a guy walks by, and you're like, oh yeah, he's supposed to be David Byrne.
I thought there was a scene where they were on the stage, and they were supposed to be talking heads.
I think they may be playing
a
tune. I don't know. I didn't watch the movie.
Do they play a tune? Play a ditty.
But anyway, and Jerry Harrison on keyboards and second guitar.
Second guitar.
But anyway, I wish I had Wikipedia because I don't have any internet right now, but we'll be referring to Wikipedia a little bit.
Is that another one of their records, Joe?
No, but before their first album came out, they had a single. Back when bands used to release singles before the albums came out. Let's just hear a little tiny piece of it here. It's called Love... ...
Be a Lady Tonight.
Be a Lady Tonight. Love Be a Lady Tonight. Love Building on Fire. I'm actually a big fan of this song.
This is a very good song.
You love Bird Cheapy.
Oh, I love it. I do really like the harpsichord sample that he's got going on in this song. This is like a very conventional sounding like single for them.
I mean,
it doesn't really have a lot of the jammy sort of elements that some of their later stuff has.
Or like the jangly paranoia shit that goes on.
This is very... It's a very structured...
It also has a horn section.
...tune, yeah. The horn section is good. The saxophone in it could do without. But it's a good...
It's so weird that you hate an instrument.
I like some people who play it. I like Blue Note New York Jazz when they play with the saxophone. Anyone... Like, Kenny G...
I don't like Kenny G either. Nobody likes Kenny G.
Why are you wearing a Kenny G shirt then?
I'm not.
Right now.
It's just a black shirt.
Yeah. Repping the... whitest man who's ever played the saxophone.
He's pretty white.
Kenny G. But that was their first single? What was the B-side of that single? You didn't know that? I thought that's why you brought it up.
Okay. No, I was just saying that before the album came out, that was the first thing that they released. I don't own the single. I wish I did, but...
Ugh. Well, this is
ruined. I'll look it up.
Okay. But... Overall, what are your overall thoughts of the record
on that song?
Talking Heads 77.
I think that it's a really good album. It's one of the best debut albums ever, because very rarely do bands that good when they start out.
That's what I wanted to say about Talking Heads 77. So good thing you said it. Now I don't have to. Rarely is the debut record
the
from a band. The
B-side was New Feeling.
That's a good song.
It is a good song.
The debut record of a band. Like, it was such a realized sound for that band. Like, usually when you hear, like, a band in its infancy, their first record is kind of scattered and they're kind of trying to find what they want to sound like. And I know that Talking Heads totally develop a lot more from that record and they branch out a lot more. However, that album and, like, Murmur, like R.E.M.'s first record, are both really solid records that right out of the gate they have a confidence and their songwriting is really, really strong, and the entirety of the record is like a solid, you know, almost perfect record where they have a developed sound and they have a really confident idea of the kind of music that they want to make. Now, obviously, they evolve a lot from that point, and they evolve from 77, but initially, I mean, 77 from beginning to end is an exceptionally solid, solid record.
I very much agree. As I've been listening to it a lot this week, and I would say that what's interesting to me about this...
Oh my god, me too, Joe!
What are the chances? It's almost like I texted you and told you to listen to them a lot so we could record this podcast.
I think that's exactly the reason.
Oh, so it's not that much of a coincidence.
Well, no.
Okay.
Kismet!
Yes, kismet. That's exactly right. The thing I like the best about this album is listening to it, especially in retrospect, since I know their later albums also so well.
I listen to it in
headphones.
You
can hear... I also listen to it in headphones, yes. You're a good joker. But I noticed that you can pretty much hear the blueprint for a lot of the places they were going to go for the rest of their career on that album. But let's go through the tracks, Rob. The first single off this album was Uh-Oh, Love Comes to Town.
the first track, or was that also a single?
It was also the first single, in addition to being the first track.
Spectacular first track.
Let's hear a little taste of...
I love this song.
All Love Comes to Town. It's kind of a great...
It's such a great beginning, an intro into the band. Okay, now, can I stop you for a second?
Okay.
I need to talk about Tina fucking Weymouth.
If you promise to stop calling her Tina fucking Weymouth, then sure.
Fucking Weymouth.
Tina Weymouth.
So, as a... You're a bass player.
Thanks. I can play bass, yeah. I would hardly call it a bass
but
player.
But you appreciate bands with good bass players.
The Talking Heads have a good bass player.
There's multiple bands where the bass is a completely different approach for that band. For example, like Kim Deal from the Pixies, I think, is one of my favorite musicians in general of all time. I think she's a genius. But I love the Breeders and I love the Pixies and I love Kim Deal's solo
stuff.
It's
just Pixies. It's just Breeders.
But her style of bass, specifically for the Pixies, was very, very stripped down, just going to play basically the root notes along with it. Tina fucking Weymouth.
Stop that. That's so annoying. And disrespectful.
What she does this... It's not really subtle, because a lot of bands... we'll have a bass player that plays something that really, really brings up the entire band around them and makes everything sound infinitely more solid. But it's kind of a subtle line that you only really notice if you're playing, if you're paying really close attention. Whereas Mrs.
Fucking Weymouth.
Fucking Weymouth.
Fucking Weymouth.
What she does is less subtle. It's way more of an obvious bass line. But everything that she plays is so well calculated and makes every song sound... so much better, so much jazzier, funkier. She is easily in my top 10
she's very, very
favorite bass players of all time.
I'm
genius.
A big fan. I think that one of the reasons that she's so good is that, like, the rhythm section of Talking Heads is really strong.
And
a big part of that is because Chris Franz plays very basically.
Mm-hmm.
He does not play anything particularly fancy, and all the fancy rhythms and stuff that they get into in later albums is partly because they have additional percussionists and whatnot. But he just plays like totally solid, straightforward rock drums.
New wave.
And so the rhythm section itself gets filled in mostly by Tina and her bass. Does most of the heavy lifting in that rhythm section.
Yeah. Also, specifically with this song, something that I love straight out of the gate, the melody is a complex melody. And she matches it perfectly. And I love when you hear like a simple melody on a guitar and the bass is just that octave lower and it totally fills up the entire thing. Now, I know that that's kind of contrary to what I was saying before, because usually she goes off on her own tangent and builds something completely independent from what Byrne or what's the other guitar player's name?
Well, Jerry Harrison plays keys and sometimes plays backup guitar.
Typically, she does something completely independent of what else is going on in the band. But in this instance, in she's matching it, and it sounds so seamless. And it's like, it's just such a good single song. And
you know,
I,
my favorite bass line of hers, and we'll get to this album. But my favorite bass line.
I have one.
Do you know what is it?
Mine is Found a Job.
Found a Job. That's not my favorite bass line of hers. It's a good song. My favorite bass line that she does is in Ezimbra.
That's it. I was just listening to that record on the way here.
Ezimbra. We'll get to that.
All right.
We'll get to it. But we're still talking about 77 here. But anyway, that's my favorite bass line that she does.
That's a very good bass line.
I think, anyway. My favorite bass line is typically whichever one I heard last.
That's fair. But I teach a lot of her bass lines because I teach little punks how to play Talking Head songs a lot.
What I love is that Talking Heads get lumped in with punk bands all the time, but they really are the least punk band.
Oh, they're not punk
at all.
They're
a bunch of art school nerds who made a pop band.
But same with Devo and with early R.E.M. They totally fit
early
in.
Early Devo, though, like, if you listen, especially the hardcore stuff from before the first album, if you listen to their, like, they just put out two or three CDs of, like, archival stuff from, like, 74 to 77. And a lot of those tunes that once Brian Eno gets in there and produces it on that debut album, they have that Devo sound, but the early stuff is way more like jangly punk rocky. Not as punk rock, because like I was talking to Nicole about this today, my wife. We were talking about doing this show, and she said, you know, some other bands that we could do. And I said, yeah, I don't know what punk rock bands I'd want to do, because for a lot of the, I mean, not that, and this isn't even a criticism of punk rock, but punk rock intentionally sounds the same on every album because mm-hmm. punk rock is more about the attitude and the performance than actually about the music for most punk rock bands. So like doing Bad Religion and NoFX would be fucking boring because all of their albums sound exactly the same.
I was thinking about doing punk rock bands too, but the punk rock bands that I was thinking of are bands like I know that we're never going to do it, but Propagandhi would actually be an interesting band to do because their albums all grow. Descendants, just because I'm obsessed with the Descendants.
I mean, I like the...
And talking about Descendants and all would be fun, but I don't think we'll...
This is better suited for after the mics are turned off, Rob.
Dead Kennedys, that would be a band to do, but there's only four.
We
can
do it in two episodes, though, because...
Exactly.
Anything that happens with that name after Jello Biafra is unnecessary to talk about.
Yeah, but they had a good four records with Jello.
They have a really, really awesome two albums and then two pretty good ones.
Frankenchrist is pretty good, but Bedtime for Democracy is amazing.
I think the only one of their albums that I think is amazing is Fresh Fruit for Rotting. Why are we talking about this? We're talking about... This is the Talking Heads show.
I thought this was Rob Knows Music featuring Joey.
Yeah.
And this first heads, episode, talking which heads. Is Talking Heads, Talking Heads. That's the first episode.
Yeah. It's not Talking Heads, Talking fucking Jello Biafra. Damn, now I want Jello.
Now I want Biafra. If you know what I mean. But for real. Okay. I guess that, like, them getting lumped in with a lot of the punk rock sort of newer stuff with the time.
It has more to do with the fact that they were at CBGB. Like, in that New York scene, playing at the same club as the Ramones. They opened for the Ramones in their first show at
CBGB. The Ramones!
They, you know, Television played there.
That would be a boring band to cover every one of their records.
I actually like Television.
Television?
Yeah.
Oh, I was talking about the Ramones.
I wouldn't do it because after their first four albums, I don't want to listen to them. After the fifth album, there's like maybe one song per album sometimes that's good.
Yeah.
The Ramones are one of those bands where if you have their first and third albums, you have the greatest hits and you don't...
Rocket to Russia.
Yeah, Rocket to Russia is fantastic. I meant one and two then. Ramones and Rocket to Russia are fantastic, and then 3, 4, and 5 have some really good tunes on them, but they also have a lot of filler.
And then the rest
of their career is all filler with an occasional killer.
All killer?
No, all filler.
All filler, occasional. Sometimes.
Anyway, next week we're going to be doing Sum 41, but that's not till next week. But yeah, we both agree. Oh, Love Comes to Town. Spectacular beginning.
It's kind of neat
just though because it's one of the... It's an interesting beginning because it doesn't get you full into the full-on, weird, jangly, anxious paranoia of David Byrne. Until
it doesn't get to the point where they seem like they're getting electrocuted. The first track has something that...
Guitars.
Oh, God. I think it's got two. Yeah. And if you include the bass, three.
I call that the dead guitar.
There is a specific melody halfway through the song that I love the melody, but... hate the instrument choice that they decided to record it on. There's a steel drum solo.
Oh, I love it.
It's a great melody. It's fantastic. Steel drums are awesome. No, steel drums are not awesome. Steel drums
are
like...
How are you going to be able to cope when we get to all their like weird African influence stuff? Like right now,
steel drums are like getting cornrows on vacation. You think it's like a great idea when you're there, and then you get home and you realize it's fucking stupid and it never sounds
good. Steel drums are fantastic. You're just a fucking snob.
No, it doesn't make me a snob.
That's exactly what it makes.
No, it makes me someone who doesn't like
and steel drums and having weird blanket rules about steel drums makes you a snob. The cornrows joke, I'll give you. That was funny.
Yes.
The steel drum is all. It's such a, like a happy Caribbean sounding song.
Makes me think of Toucan Sam.
And that's a bad breakfast. Thing?
That's a good
that sounds like it's more on you than on David Byrne.
No, I give them the melody. Take away that point for that one point. Now they're only up 10 points.
They're zero again.
They're at zero, yeah. Take it away for that steel drum. Horse shit. Take that shit. The fuck out of it. I do have lots of weird blanket rules about records.
You have a lot of
One of them, Talking Heads, really, I mean, just...
What are you trying to say? Spit it out.
Just, I mean, dumb son of a solid. Bitch. Every record. I think the perfect number of songs for a record is 11.
Oh, I hate when 11. You listen to this bullshit. This is so stupid.
No. I just think that that's the perfect length for a record. And their first three, 11 songs. Perfect.
Fucking stupid.
Perfect length for a record. 12? One too long.
You're a fucking 10? Idiot.
One Too Short.
I don't actually have rules about how... I mean, we've talked about this before, but I actually do agree that when albums were still being recorded originally on vinyl, or at least released on vinyl, and they were limited in track space, you know, 30 to 40 minutes was the average length of an album, unless you had a double album. But nowadays, everything's a double album because they all fill up that 80-minute CD, and that's why so many songs aren't very good.
Exactly.
It's hard to come up with that many good songs. Plus, they used to have an album come out every single year, and now they get one every 4 years.
Yeah, what is that? I don't get that. Joey,
well, I think it's mostly because they don't make any money selling albums.
That's a good point. So you have to tour. They have to tour on those albums, Joey.
And, you know, that was something that was interesting that I was reading about Talking Heads, is that they were originally very much a touring or a live band. All these songs were written to be played live and not written for the records. So they were all songs that were workshopped and played live long before they were recorded, at least until we get into the third and fourth albums.
Because there are some tracks on 77 that I think sound better live.
Most of their songs sound better live.
Yes.
They're a really strong live band. But they stopped touring after Stop Making Sense.
Son of a bitch. Will we get to that point? Should I ask why now? Or is that going to be a spoiler?
I think they just decided it would be kind of hard to top that. So.
Well,
and
we
also
don't
they
need to do
get,
that
doing
episode
other
now.
Stuff as well.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Anyway, so like we say, All Over Comes to Town, really good. So then we get into the jingly jangly, anxious paranoia of the Talking Heads with New Feeling.
That is the guitar tone. Impeccable. Such good tone.
So it's very much this jangly, nervy sound.
I love that sound.
That will come to define Talking Heads.
I really, really love their guitar sound. I've always loved their guitar sound.
I like
love
it a lot.
I love
That's
the way
David
that Byrne. Even all their earliest to all their to their stuff before they broke up, all their stuff, even though I haven't heard two of their records, really, really astounding guitar tone. Really
David
high,
Byrne's
trebly.
Amazing.
David Byrne guitar tone is spectacular.
David Byrne is... My favorite thing about Talking Heads is actually David Byrne's vocals.
David Byrne... Oh, my God. So...
Okay. Sounds like you have something to say. I killed your baby today. That's another band we're not going to
a
do.
A lot of my... I've noticed Misfits. Most... No, fuck no. There's only one good Misfits record.
Is it the Babylon one that I like? No. Hollywood. The Static Age, it's called.
That's kind of like a compilation.
Well, no, because it was originally supposed to be an album, and they ended up releasing it as four EPs, but they have since re-released it as an album.
It is very good, but Earth AD is the only one I really, really love in its entirety. But, well, then why did you ask?
Just get on with your fucking point.
I was thinking about most of my favorite vocalists are all conventionally horrible, but I mean...
Yeah, but David Byrne definitely doesn't fall into that category.
No. But I mean, no, he can sing. Absolutely. So can Tom Waits. But I mean, when you look at it from a standpoint of what would be normal, sort of a mainstream vocalist that's easy, like that's approachable, that's like,
okay,
that has vocal stylings that are normal. David Byrne fucking sounds like a warbly bird in a lot of these songs. And it's awesome.
On the first two
and
albums,
I love
yes.
it. And
his early stuff, as he learns to sing, he gets better. Yeah,
but,
I do agree. His earlier stuff has a lot more like affectation to it. To cover up his inability to sing, I guess.
Yes.
And as he becomes a better singer, that becomes less and less.
Yeah. Yeah, and on this especially, he experiments and starts doing the really crazy falsetto that he gets really good at. On this one, he's not really good. Like, we'll get to that track eventually, halfway through.
I'm pretty sure Remain in Light is the first album he actually sings in his regular register.
Oh, yeah?
Is that? I think that's... I'm pretty sure it's either that or I might be forgetting some stuff on Fear of Music, but it's not till like the third or fourth album that he starts to sing in like his regular register.
Midway through this record, I think it's New Day.
Because his early stuff, he does a lot more of like, you're right, the falsetto and barking.
Yes, and I love that.
I love the barking.
I think it's
too.
Fantastic. Or Happy Day on track four, I think. He does a lot of the, like that crazy falsetto that makes him sound like a maniac. And he's struggling to hit those higher notes, and then just when he hits the highest that he can possibly do, he then just kind of shakes down, like he's exploding at the peak, and then does that thing, and it sounds awesome. All my favorite vocalists,
it's very B-52.
Yeah, so many of my favorite vocalists are that kind of style. Like Frank Black is horrible, and barks like a dog. Tom Waits sounds. Oh, I love those. And later on in the record, there's some where he just kind of explodes at the peak of it. But guys like Stephen Malkmus, not a good singer. Not good. But his voice is one of my favorite voices, and his melodies are impeccable. Guys like Isaac Brock, people like, well, Nick Cave just sounds kind of like a date rapist. But I love his voice, and they sound really cool. And David Byrne, I'm going to say this. I think David Byrne is to, like, pop music what, like, Tom Waits is to weird blues and jazz, and what Nick Cave is to kind of gothic sort of ballad tone stuff.
Yeah. Name two other... Name three bands that do gothic ballad tone stuff.
The Cure? AFI?
AFI! Fuck off! A Frozen Indian.
So a Frozen Indian?
Someone sure told me that in high school.
Frozen Indian.
I believe them. And I was like, really? That's awesome. But, like, no, it's a fire inside. I'm like, oh, I like Frozen Indians better. Not that I think you should freeze Indians. I just thought it was a funny name.
But anyway.
What was your point, Rob?
I think he's
one
really
of the...
He's
really good? He's a good singer? Yeah, I agree.
Pretty good. It's pretty good. It's all right.
Well, see if you can guess what the second single from this album was.
Not Psycho Killer.
It was Psycho Killer.
No.
Yep.
I already said it wasn't.
No, I'm telling you it is, though. Psycho Killer was the second single from this album. And since I know you're going to fucking ask me, let me just look, because I don't actually know what the B-side was. Because you'd be like, what was the B-side?
Joe.
Oh, the B-side was the acoustic version of Psycho Killer.
Oh, okay. Because I was about to ask, Joe, what was the B-side?
Psycho Killer is the only song on Talking Heads 77 that is not written by David Byrne exclusively. It's written by the whole band.
That's cool.
Every other song on the album is a David Byrne composition.
What I really like is how many times they've revisited Psycho Killer, and then three of the main versions. I mean, the one that I'm most familiar with is the one off Stop Making Sense, which is still my favorite version.
Because it's him solo with a drum machine.
It sounds awesome. It's my favorite version. It's very, very cool. The acoustic version, that's the B-side,
which is quite
I actually like more than the original recording.
I don't.
The original recording?
It also adds that weird extra verse in the acoustic version.
Yeah.
I don't like the extra verse. I can see why they removed it for the recording, because it doesn't fit as well as the other ones. That harmonic there is really cool, though.
Very cool.
There's that. It's cliche to say, but this is the most iconic song off this album. It's my favorite song off this album. It's an insanely good pop song.
This is your favorite song on the record?
On this album, yeah.
You want to know? Hey, Joe.
I'm going to assume your favorite is... You want to know which one mine is? Let me think. Let me just have a look and see here.
Have a little look-see.
What would be Rob's favorite on this record? The Book I Read? It's got a cool riff.
It's a very cool riff.
No, that's not the Book I Read. What's your favorite?
Who is it? Who is it?
Who is it's pretty good, too.
I love it.
This is like the funkiest white man funk song,
right?
On the album, yeah.
Isn't it great? I love it. And the bass line in the back again. I also love those. I love the song, even though typically some of my favorite features of songs are the lyrics, the lyrical content.
I love the lyrics for this band.
The lyrics in this song aren't really much. It's mostly just him saying, "Who is it?" I also really love songs that are clearly just like, well, he had
most of their
he had a melody reading, and then kind of just threw words in, or that's what it seems
Brian
like to
Eno
me
making a joke talking about him and David Byrne writing music together and saying, yeah, you might not think that we spend a lot of time on the lyrics, and you'd be right, but it's because like they always write the music and then he comes up with the melody and then he just does like lots of recordings of like free lyric kind of stuff and then writes the lyrics around them. I always liked bands like this where it's more important that the lyrics sound good than that they be really wonderful poetry. Because 99% of the time, like, I've heard some of, for example, you've talked about bands you really like and told me lyrics you really like off of certain albums. You're like, that's my favorite lyric. And I'm like, I guess it's a neat little lot of poetry, but I don't like how it sounds. And like, okay, perfect example is Bad Religion. I know you love his lyrics.
Yes.
And he kind of makes them work with his voice, but like, I don't like, and then some of his messages and the lyrics themselves are really good if you read them as poems, but if I hear him try to sing them, I'm just like, it doesn't, you can't fit fecundity into that phrasing. It doesn't fit. Like you're forcing your lyrics into this song with a goddamn crowbar. You're like, I'm gonna fit this fucking word in if it kills me.
Wow.
And I'm just like,
I love when vocalists do that.
And that's, it's just different styles, but I just, and you know, same with my other favorite band, Phish. It's always, and that's obviously a thing that they totally were influenced by David Byrne by, in that it's more important that the lyrics just sound good in the song than that they be brilliant lyrics. I like a lot of his lyrics as well, because he has lots of like weird, nerdy, irony stuff in a lot of his songs. And then the first, and actually the first time he does like a sincere love song without any trace of irony, or there's still some because it's Talking Heads, but it's like his actual, like, no, I'm going to make a really nice, sweet love song. And it's really, really good. But it's on like their fifth album, and it's Naive Melody, This Must Be the Place.
I love that song.
Which is the one he sings to a lamp in Stop Making Sense.
Aww.
The love song he sings
that's
to a lamp.
So cute.
Yeah.
That's so cute.
I can't wait to talk about that live album.
I do really, really love lyrical content. For me, weirdly enough, is like the first thing I notice in a band, which I really love.
I have to like actually force myself to sit and, even if I know all the words, I have to force myself to actually think about them and think, like, trying to think of what they mean, because I don't ever notice them ever.
Oh,
even if I've memorized them half the time, I've been singing this song for 5 years and I just now like this. An example from They Might Be Giants, one of my other favorite bands. They have a song called They'll Need a Crane. And I knew every word to that song. I was singing it forever. And after like 4 years, I finally like sat down and thought about the lyrics. And went, this is the saddest song I've ever heard. It's a really sad song. And most They Might Be Giant songs are like incredibly nihilistic and apocalyptic.
Yeah.
But I would never know.
Yeah. A lot of my favorite bands like The Mountain Goats or Andrew Jackson Jihad.
I find the Mountain Goats lyrics so earnest that they make me cringe a lot of the time.
Oh,
they're really
my
good.
God.
He's a spectacular lyricist, but I'm just like, it makes me uncomfortable to be hearing you being this earnest.
That's why.
Come
oh
on,
my
buddy,
God.
Bring in some fucking irony here.
It makes me so happy.
I need some irony or
it's
some
my
gibberish.
Favorite gibberish, I can get behind. I was just listening to the new Mountain Goats single, which you would totally love.
I like the Mountain Goats.
Do you know what their new record is about?
I don't care.
Javo Guerrera.
Oh, what's it about?
It's about wrestling. It's about Javo Guerrera.
Javo?
Yeah.
Do you mean Chavo?
Yeah.
Chavo Guerrero?
Yeah.
Not Javo Guerrera?
Nope. Javo Guerrera.
Chavo Guerrero?
Pretty sure that my...
He wrote an album about Chavo Guerrero?
Yeah. Because he was obsessed with wrestling when he
junior
was growing up.
Junior or senior?
Senior.
Chavo Guerrero Senior, like Eddie Guerrero's brother.
Eddie Guerrero's dad, I thought. It's about Eddie Guerrero's dad.
Okay, that's not Chavo Guerrero then. Chavo Guerrero Sr. was Eddie's brother because his son is Chavo Guerrero Jr., who was Eddie's nephew, and Chavo Guerrero Jr. is one that you and I grew up watching wrestle. He wrestles for Lucha Underground now.
I'm going to find out.
You mean Juventud Guerrero? No, Juventud Guerrero is a different guy altogether.
Because I know that their new record is about the father of
Eddie Guerrero. Maybe his name was also Chavo Guerrero, I don't know.
Because
maybe Chavo Guerrero named his son Chavo Guerrero, who named his son Chavo Guerrero.
Maybe, because I know the single talks specifically about his sons, or one of his sons, Edward, or Edward.
Well,
Eddie,
maybe
that
Chavo's
goes on to be famous.
Dad was also named Chavo.
I'm going to find this out, Joe.
Or maybe I'm wrong. Maybe Chavo Guerrero Jr. is the grandson of Chavo Guerrero, and Eddie's brother was named something else. I guess I don't actually know.
The album comes out in April. It is called Beat the Champ, and it is about Chavo Guerrero.
Senior, okay. So maybe Chavo's son...
Chavo Guerrero Sr. Better known as Chavo Guerrero or Chavo Guerrero Sr. Yeah.
So I guess that means that Eddie's brother's name isn't Chavo. I thought it was. Goes to show what little I know about the Guerrero dynasty.
Well, no. His son...
Eddie and...
I'm looking and can't fucking find it. But anyway, the track that I was listening to is about him growing up watching Chavo Guerrero wrestle. And then just about the legend of Chavo Guerrero is what it's called. And then the whole record is about him, called Beat the Champ.
Oh, cool.
I love John Darnielle. And I just read his book, and he's one of my heroes.
I have a copy of it somewhere.
It's
amazing.
But I really love, earnest lyrics. I love lyrics that actually make me feel like I'm listening to someone read their diary out loud. Like Tom Gable, Laura Jane Grace now, a lot of his early... There's one song by, before Laura Jane Grace became... Laura Jane Grace was still Tom Gable. Against Me has a song called Searching for a Former Clarity, where the lyrics like almost make me cry every time, and I love that. There's one lyric where
you're a big loser.
Where way before he actually admitted to having gender dysphoria, there's a lyric that goes confessing childhood secrets of dressing up in women's clothes, compulsions you never knew, the reasons to...
Okay, see, I knew I wasn't crazy. He's Eddie Guerrero's brother.
Oh, I thought it was Eddie
Guerrero. He's the older brother of Eddie Guerrero. And his son, Chavo Jr., and he's Vicky Guerrero's brother-in-law because she married Eddie, of course. Okay, I got it.
Okay.
I knew I wasn't crazy.
Well, then I
was
wrong.
Eddie's brother.
Look at you go.
I don't know that I've ever actually seen... I mean, I'm sure I have seen Chavo Guerrero Sr. wrestle, but I can't remember.
Okay. The point I was trying to make was that...
On our
Who Is It
podcast.
In Who Is It, you can clearly tell the melody that he comes up with is based off of he had...
Probably.
You know, I saw a great documentary called Some Kind of Monster about Metallica. Anyway.
Did they do that in that movie?
There's a really funny bit where they're writing the lyrics to Frantic. And
Frantic, my God.
It is one of the dumbest things I've ever seen. It's James Hetfield singing into a microphone, typically what singers do. I'm in the biz, Joe. I'm a musician.
That's I'm an amateur.
Why nobody buys your records.
Could be part of the reason.
Also, in this bit, it's Bob Rock sitting in a chair, like not looking at Hetfield, but he's bobbing his head, Bob Rock in his head, and to James Hetfield trying to write the lyrics, and it's him going, like his eyes are closed and he's so intense and his headphones are on. He's like, "Your actions make me frantic, TikTok." And fucking Lars Ulrich is in the background being like, "Yeah, it's good." And they stop it. "Oh, James, do the tick tick thing. Oh, do that tick tick thing again. That was great. Yeah, you guys like that." And they're taking it so hyper seriously. I want to kick them all in the noggins.
What I want to do is ask you a question, and that's, why the fuck did you watch that movie? What is wrong with you?
I do.
Anyway, we need to get on to the next album, but before we do, this was the last single off this album. The third single from this album, a little number called Pulled Up.
This is a great way to end this record. I love that melody too, and I like that he just barks it.
I also
he doesn't
love,
even bother putting in words.
I love this.
Look at me now!
This album doesn't really have a low point. Like, there's no bad tunes on this record.
This is one of the records that I will listen. If I ever want to listen to the Talking Heads, this will be one that I'll throw on. There's some that we'll get into it, but this one, along with, I keep bringing up REM, but because I've been listening to so much REM lately, Murmur and Document are ones that I always just throw on. Just because I love... those albums in a whole, there isn't really a low point for me. You're staring at me unsettlingly.
I agree with you. I mean, it's a really great album. I think Talking Heads is one of the few bands that I think have four perfect albums in a row. Like, their first four albums, to me, are about as close to perfect as it gets. Having said that, even though I think that this album is better than a lot of their later stuff, in terms of like where it falls in the ranking for me of the top eight, it's probably like fifth or sixth.
Really?
Yeah, which is really more a testament to how much I like some of the other stuff, more so than how I feel about this album, because it's a phenomenally good album.
It is. And I love it.
And also, but I also, whenever I listen to it, I'm like, yeah, I can hear all the things that I know they're going to do, and I can't wait to go hear those things.
Yeah. That's fair.
A lot of the songs on this album, though, are actually even better when on the... Which we'll get to it, but on the live album, the name of this band is Talking Heads, which is a double live album. And the first record deals with music from this era when they were still the four-piece.
Right. How much time have we gone for this?
We've been about 45, so we need to get
to... How about
this
is episode one and episode two?
All right, we're going to do...
Let's do that.
All right.
But
so we'll,
I have one more... Sorry.
Closing thoughts on Talking Heads 77 and everything we've covered so far, Rob.
Well, let me tell you.
Please do.
Talking Heads 77, I think, is almost a perfect record if it wasn't for the steel drums. But something that I think... God damn, that's a good song. So good. But...
steel drums.
In its entirety, they don't really get into the jammy sort of stuff that they jump headfirst into in the next record that we're going to talk to. Maybe not headfirst, but they jump a little bit into it.
There's no jamminess on the second album at all. It's just a tighter version of the first album.
My God!
You're nuts.
No, but anyway. What I feel about it is that it's got way more concise song structure that doesn't really lend itself to a lot of jamming, I don't think.
It's very, very good, but it's like, you can see more, it's more like somebody drew a blueprint of a house and being like, you know, imagine this wall here and imagine couch there.
No, I don't.
And you were like, yeah, yeah, I can see that being really, really awesome. This looks great right now, but it's going to look even better when you put the walls in.
See, I think that it's a fully developed sound and record that then explodes into several other avenues. But I think that this was kind of the last one that was very, very concise.
See, they peaked with their first album. Was like,
No, I'm saying absolutely they didn't.
Goddamn right they didn't.
However, I think that the approach to this record is the only time they really approached a record very song by song by song. Whereas all the other ones, I think, have a flow to them and kind of...
Yeah, but that's a good thing. Like,
no, it's a good thing. However, some albums that don't necessarily flow together like a concept or anything, that don't bleed one track into the next, is just like a perfect amalgam of 11 songs, just a really great collection of those tunes. I think is equally good. Like, I would say, like, Mule Variations by Tom Waits is a brilliant record because those songs have a way of complementing each other in a collection. Work better as a whole. Whereas records like Remain in Light, which we will talk about, is a perfect from the sequencing of that record, even in itself, flows from one to the next.
Spoiler alert, it's the best album ever recorded by anyone ever.
Well, that's crazy, but. It's not that crazy. It's a pretty good record. It's a pretty good record. Spoiler. But do you kind of see what I'm talking about? Where
I do, but I disagree with your premise because, like, by that notion, then all of... With that logic, every band's best album would be their greatest hits album.
Mm-mm. Not at all, because the...
Because it's a bunch of individual songs that are all great and perfectly realized, but they don't flow with one another as well. Because they're not designed to.
Not necessarily, because I think if you take them out of sequence in the first record, it doesn't hold the same weight.
Then it's the same as the other records.
No, I think because the other records have certain songs that by themselves I don't think are as independently strong as some of the ones on this record.
I see what you mean.
Whereas they feed better being between this one, leading into the next one.
I do see what you mean. Like I say, I don't agree, even though I like every song on that first album. But I like every song on that album, but the ones that I listen to the most would be the single that wasn't even on the album, Love Goes.